minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
Cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Okay, sorry about that, folks. Script didn't work exactly as I intended because I had renamed a directory. Fortunately, I was able to fix it quickly enough that the change was almost seamless. But yes, where are we? So it is Saturday, the 13th of April in the glorious future year of 2024, and I am coming to you from the city of Munich, capital of the Free State of Bavaria in southern Germany. And the, let's see, which of course implies that very recently I engaged in international air travel, which is true. I took a flight from DFW to Paris on Tuesday. And, you know, it's just not a terribly enjoyable experience. And I know I've said it before, and undoubtedly I'll say it again. You know, I want to travel some other way than by air. You know, people say, oh, well, you know, it's this, that, the other thing. I don't actually have an objection to international or transoceanic long-distance air travel. You know, some people do object to it, and I don't. You know, people say, it uses fossil fuels. Well, yes, you know, aviation is pretty much one of the most difficult things to decarbonize in terms of significant uses of fossil fuels. But on the other hand, the benefit per unit of fossil fuel consumed is particularly large. So that I'm not particularly worried about. You know, the truth is that it's air transport that makes it possible to do things like organ transplants in many cases. Right. And I certainly don't begrudge quick movement of parcels. But just personally, right, from a personal point of view, I'd rather go by ship. That I'd rather take 4 or 5 days where I can get up, you know, walk around, that kind of thing, rather than spend 10 hours with my knees jammed under my chin in, you know, basic economy cattle call class. But unfortunately, the opportunities for doing that are few and far between these days. You know, in 2020, I had a plan to travel by cargo ship, but cargo ships basically stopped taking passengers owing to the COVID-19 pandemic, and they haven't started up again. So, but yes, I took the flight to Charles de Gaulle, and then from Charles de Gaulle, I took the train, the local train into Paris, and then from Paris, I took the TGV to Munich. And of course, on the Paris to Strasbourg run, you know, it goes Paris, Strasbourg, and then Karlsruhe, Stuttgart, Ulm, Augsburg, Munich. And so there's nonstop run at 300 kilometers an hour, or rather more than that, between Paris, Gare de l'Est, and Strasbourg. And of course, being France, the electricity is mostly nuclear. And so running under the wire at 320 kilometers an hour, sustained speed 315, you know, people are always saying, oh, you can't make a nuclear-powered train. I beg to differ. I've ridden in one. I mean, yes, you know, the thing is, as Philip Sporn observes, you know, nuclear power, because the main thing we have developed nuclear power for is supplying electricity in central station electric supply applications. You know, nuclear power doesn't do anything any other source of electricity couldn't do. This is true. On the other hand, it does what central station electric generating plants do very, very well. And it is, I would say, noteworthy that in the 1970s in particular, there was a lot of anti-electricity agitation from pretty much, in many cases, the very same people who are now demanding the electrification of everything. And the reason was, they said, well, you know, nuclear power and electricity match so well that using electricity is just an excuse for them, the big capital T, them, the they of them, to build more nuclear power plants. So we certainly don't want that, because nuclear power is sinister and evil. Anyway. I think of this in particular, there was a book back when the Irish Electricity Supply Board was planning to build a nuclear power plant at Carnsore Point. There was a book published denouncing nuclear power in Ireland that, you know, again, I saw it for sale on eBay. I was reading the table of contents and a couple of other pages that were in the item description, but the whole thing was clearly a rant against electricity, saying that, you know, this is something we don't need and don't want and shouldn't have, and it's morally bad, apparently on the argument that, you know, electricity is what powers pinball machines, and, you know, P rhymes with T, and T is what, you know, and trouble begins with T, right? There's trouble in River City. I know I've done that before, and probably more elegantly than I did this time, but it's still the idea. But the thing that really got me about that particular bit of argumentation was that not too distant in time, I had been in Dublin for the World Science Fiction Convention in 2019, and while I was there in Dublin, I saw a listing for an exhibit at the National Museum, the Country Life branch of the Irish National Museum. I didn't get out to it, and I still haven't found out whether they did an exhibition book, because if they did, I want a copy of it. But it was specifically an exhibition about women's experiences of rural electrification, headlined with a quote from some old lady saying, "Heaven, this must be heaven," talking about having electric kitchen appliances. Particularly a dishwasher and laundry machines, so that the back-breaking labor she'd been doing, tiresome, tedious labor she'd been doing all her life, could suddenly be done with a press of a button. You know, and there are still people who seem to believe that something about this, you know, saps your moral fiber or something. I have no longing to return to an easier and, you know, return to a simpler time when life was much less easy. Yes, less complex, but also less easy. Look, I'm not an insulin-dependent diabetic, so I wouldn't die within a day. Right? You know, it's only since the 1920s, you know, 100 years now, only since the 1920s that insulin has been available. But, you know, insulin, you know, you say, oh, it's a simpler time. A simpler doesn't translate to easier. Matter of fact, there's a report which is issued every year by the New York City Department of Public Health. It's been issued every year for at least since, I don't know, the 1920s. Anyway, the title of this report, and they've retained the original title, which I think is wonderful. The title of this report is The Conquest of Pestilence. And it shows, the headline item in The Conquest of Pestilence is a graph showing mortality rates, aggregate mortality rates in New York City, beginning, I think, in the 1820s. Well, here, let me, because I've got it here. Let's see. Pestilence. There we are. Yeah, okay. Well, that's where it is. All right. But yeah, let me look at this. 2021. Come on. Where are you? Yeah, there we are. So yes, the conquest of pestilence in New York City as shown by the death rate recorded in the official records of the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. And it starts a little after 1800. With a smallpox epidemic in 1804, yellow fever in 1805, smallpox again, yellow fever again in 1822, smallpox again in 1824, cholera in 1832, measles in 1836, seven scarlet fever, smallpox and cholera in 1834, so on. Anyway, the death rate per 1,000 population peaks in 1837, I guess, at 50. Death rate per 1,000 population, owing to the COVID-19 pandemic, rose to 9, which is the highest it's been since 1994. And at that time, it looks like that bump is due to HIV. Anyway, they've got a number of little indications here showing various things that assisted in bringing these rates down. 1842, Croton Aqueduct opened. 1866, Board of Health and Prison Health Department established. 1907, control of typhoid carriers. 1910, chlorination of water. 1911, milk stations for babies inaugurated. 1912, pasteurization of milk. I don't actually know much about this business of milk stations for babies. But I'm guessing that the purpose of it was to provide infants with something reliable to consume. Anyway, and so I look at these graphs and I think about people's expectations. I know I do tend to talk about expectations. I like that. 1901, 1902, smallpox, last epidemic. 1904, meningitis. 1918, influenza. They give you the, of course, growing population as well as the absolute number of deaths. So that 410, you know, so 2,219 deaths from meningitis in 1904 actually made for a higher overall death rate than 12,562 deaths from influenza in 1918. Although, again, there's other background items in here like chlorination of water, control of typhoid carriers, and so on. Anyway, but it's a really good graph, I think. Now, what's interesting is the change in population over time. Anyway, but maybe I'll put that graph up so that everyone else can look at it. Put it up on the Anon Radio Archive page for this week's show so that I won't just sound like I'm babbling. temporizing. Using up time because I have no idea what to do with it. But so yes, I keep thinking about expectations. And because people today expect certain things and they have a certain worldview that it's very easy to forget that things haven't always been a particular way. One example, I suppose, and I was thinking about this earlier, I saw a recipe that someone had posted online, and it was from Grandma's Molasses, and the recipe said, uses only a quarter cup of sugar. And the person who posted it with he's saying, FYI, molasses has the same number of calories as sugar. And I'm looking at the ad and saying, boy, howdy. Not only are you not paying attention to the date that this ad appeared, you also didn't pay attention to the text. Because the text says, we think this recipe is so good, you'll keep using it even when you can get sugar again. The magazine from which it was extracted is dated October 1945, which means that advertising material printed in that magazine must have been submitted at least, probably sometime in July of 45, when the Second World War was still going on, and rationing, even in the United States, food rationing was still in effect. This is a U.S. magazine. Grandma's Molasses is a U.S. brand. But food rationing, and specifically sugar rationing, was still in effect in the United States until roughly the end of 1945. They're not advertising molasses as a low-calorie substitute for sugar. No one at the time would have wanted such a thing. The United States was coming out of the Great Depression when people had literally starved to death. The idea that you would want a reduced-calorie food would have sounded like absolute gibberish to most people. This is what really gets me. People looking at food and saying, oh, well, that's so fattening or something. And I say, it's so nutritious. High caloric value foods have been in scarce supply for most of human history. In most countries in the world, down to sometime after the Second World War, the 1970s, in many of the poorer countries, let's say India and China, getting enough calories, not just, you know, and of course there's other nutrients to consider, right? It's important that you get your iron and your magnesium and all that, but if you don't have enough calories, even if the minor nutrients are all present, you're gonna die, and not slowly. And so for most people in the world, for most of human history, and indeed until quite recently, until say half a century ago, just getting those basic caloric needs filled was a struggle. And so we are now living in a world in which a substantial fraction of people in many countries actually worry about caloric excess. And I say, that's amazing! That's incredible! Now, of course, it has been remarked, right? And this gets to a comment in Com here, actually. It has been remarked that a substantial fraction of the calories in you that you get from your food, right? You always think, well, food, you know, photosynthesis, right? But there is a substantial artificial contribution, which mostly comes from fossil fuels nowadays. And of course, step one in that is nitrate fertilizer, right? Nitrate fertilizer production is a substantial consumer of fossil fuels. But You know, and then there's the heat that's used for processing, you know, heat and other forms of energy that's used for processing foods, right? Taking them from the raw grain or what have you and turning them into the form that you purchase them in. And there's the transportation energy and the cooking energy and all that. Now, I certainly would be much happier if the energy for those transformations and for the fertilizers and so on were to come from nuclear fission, which of course is a million times more calorically dense than combustion. And of course, again, as it is correctly observed by X1 and COM, the energy density in sugar, right, burning sugar, is not that much different from the energy density from burning petroleum. You know, that there's the ratio is maybe 3 to 5, because of the extra mass of the oxygen and carbohydrate. But again, when you compare that to the millionfold difference between hydrocarbon or combustion of any kind and nuclear fission, it's a big deal. So yes, I want to see, you know, we are consuming lots of calories, we human beings, and they're not all coming from the sun. And I would certainly like to see, you know, I mean, because that's I always keep trying to wrap my head around the mindset, because as I've often said, it seems to me that the objection that many people have to nuclear energy is not an objection based on facts about nuclear energy, right? It's an objection of some other kind. Now, what other kind is sort of the question there, but you know, what is the basis? You know, because there are some people who are afraid of nuclear weapons. They don't want nuclear war. Well, I certainly don't want nuclear war, but, you know, the only time that nuclear weapons have actually been used in warfare was in a war that started over oil. And, of course, Vladimir Putin these days is threatening everybody and his brother-in-law with nuclear weapons. And if it hadn't been that Germany decided that they didn't want to split those nasty atoms and instead they wanted to burn gas, and they were going to buy it from neighbor Vlad, who murders people in his basement, because surely he must be a trustworthy supplier and he would never do anything bad. Right. You know, so to my point of view, that's the that's kind of a an underlying problem, is that the fossil fuel oriented world is a world of uneven distribution of fuel resources, which gives some people a great deal of political leverage and also results in conflict from people who either don't like that leverage being used against them or want to exert it over others. At the same time, anyone who thinks that you're going to escape that by going to renewable energy really hasn't been paying much attention. Because when you look at the way that renewable energy resources are distributed around the world, you realize it's extremely uneven, right? I mean, some areas are much sunnier than others. As I never hesitate to tell you, Munich is the sunniest spot in all of Germany, and it gets about 1,800 hours of sunlight a year. 1,800 hours of sunshine a year. That's not particularly helpful. You know, and Germany, indeed, is having trouble simply paying for the power lines needed to carry wind power generated in the north of the country to the industrial south. In fact, there's been an interesting little bit of controversy here recently. You know, people keep saying, oh, well, solar is getting cheaper all the time. The price of PV modules keeps falling, and that's going to mean that all electricity will be solar soon, and there's no case for any other form of generation, blah, 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 blah. And they're always coming up with this, you know, quoting this measure, which is used statistically in studies of energy and electricity, known as LCOE, levelized cost of electricity. Well, a German energy economist recently came up with a different measure, which she calls something like LCOCL, levelized cost of carrying the load, by which she shows what I've been telling you already, that in a system, you know, it doesn't actually matter how cheap the generation is if the rest of the infrastructure cost goes up, right? Because if the cost of transmission and distribution in a traditional central station electric system is 40 to 60% of the cost of getting the kilowatt hour to the consumer, which is not atypical, then even if the generation costs nothing, right, if the input power costs nothing, but you double or triple the cost of transmission and distribution, guess what? Costs for the consumer won't go down. In fact, they will go up. And that's exactly what's actually happening in places which try to incorporate a lot of wind and solar into their grids. And so the question of how cheap the generation is a bit, well, it's a bit misleading. I mean, you know, completely getting away from the question of whether the low cost of PV modules, for example, is enabled by slave labor in Xinjiang, China, right? Completely getting away from that, assuming that wind and solar are every bit as cheap as their proponents say, which is highly dubious, nevertheless, they don't actually make energy cheaper for that reason. Anyway, the economists are all up in arms and outraged against this new measure of least, you know, levelized cost of load carriage. And Professor Veronica Grimm, who's the one who proposed it, and they've been saying, that measure is far too simplistic. And in the process, they've been saying, well, you can't possibly, the measure LCOE, which we've been using, which we've been telling you all along, shows clearly that electricity costs will fall under the Energiewende in Germany. No, it doesn't say anything like that. You can't use it to predict future energy situation. The price of energy in the future will be set by supply and demand in the marketplace. Which is just, it's ridiculous double talk and also not... not supported by facts. It's another one of these things where I dislike economists. Because, you know, the idea that, oh, the price of energy is set by supply and demand in the marketplace. I mean, that's true to an extent. For example, the price of oil is set by supply and demand in the marketplace, and OPEC has a conference every so often to decide what supply should be offered to the market in order to get the price they want with the observed demand. You know, so to say the price will be set by supply and demand in the marketplace is double talk, it's weasel words, it's prevaricating about the bush. Well, I guarantee you, you will never get much in the way of prevarication from me on A Step Farther Out. I try to avoid prevarication to the extent that I can. And if you appreciate what I'm doing, you can, of course, support me, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com/man_and_Adam. Most of all, I look forward to your cards and letters. Send those to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America, and I'll pick them up when I get home in May. I'll probably read them out on the show. I'll probably send you something in return. Coming up is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe.
See, on a Tuesday.